Hi, I'm Tegan Keating. I am the host of your new favorite public health podcast, Action Phase. I am so excited and very honored that you're listening to this first episode. Action Phase is going to be a serious adventure. We're going to look at public health practice, and what that means is public health, how it actually happens in the real world. So we're going to leave the books and the studies behind, and we're going to actually talk to people who are working. And this is going to mean that we're going to talk to a huge variety of people. Today we're starting off with someone who works in the Office of HIV Planning. Then, you know, maybe we'll talk to somebody who has something to do with Medicare, or we'll talk to doctors or nurse practitioners or people who work in nonprofits. I don't know. We're going to find out. It's going to be awesome, though, and I'm glad that you're along for the ride with me. So today we're going to talk with Brianna Morgan, who works for the Office of HIV Planning in Philadelphia, and she is awesome. I really, really like talking with her. We're going to talk basically about everything you could possibly want to know about HIV in Philadelphia, and then, you know, a little bit more about, you know, some of her other stuff that she's doing, how she got involved in this field, all that kind of good stuff. So here's the interview. I hope you enjoy it. And yeah, here she is, Brianna Morgan. I'm here with my very first guest, Brianna Morgan. She is the health planner and website developer, manager?
Coordinator.
Coordinator for the HIV Planning Council, among many other things. So, hi, Brianna.
Hi.
How's it going?
Not bad.
Good. Are you excited to be the first guest?
Oh, I'm very excited.
Good. I'm happy to have you. So, basically, what I want to start with is, how did you get into your field of health planning and website management?
And coordination.
Coordination.
It's actually very funny that coordinator is in my name, because I'm a very uncoordinated human being.
Physically?
Physically, yeah. Oh. I trip on things a lot, and, you know.
So there was no coordination test?
No, there was not. Jokes on them. But I got started by accident, basically. When I was done with college, I was looking around for jobs that matched my skill set. I knew I wanted to work in some kind of public interest or nonprofit type position, and I didn't have too much else to go on. One of the things that I had done when I was in college is I was secretary for the Self-Government Association at my college, where I had the very glamorous responsibility of taking meeting minutes.
Ooh.
Yeah. And I was searching for nonprofit jobs, found one that needed somebody to take minutes. Having a liberal arts education, that was probably my most marketable skill. So I sent, I guess it was a resume, and whatever monster.com looked like in 2007.
Right.
I applied for the job that way. And yeah. Went in for an interview, and I'm still there.
Oh, wow. So this was your first job.
It was my first job.
Wow.
Yes.
You hit the jackpot.
Right?
I think I've had like 8 jobs since graduating. That's awesome. So were you in Philly for undergrad?
I went to Bryn Mawr College, so Philly-ish.
Okay. So you were in the area. Did you want to stay here?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. I was definitely planning on staying here, so it worked out well for me.
And you wanted to do, you were interested in any kind of nonprofit, right?
Pretty much, yeah. My educational background was international politics.
Okay.
And peace and conflict studies and international economics, so literally all over the place in the whole world.
Yeah.
That's
a broad major.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. The kind of thing that you think that you can study when you're about 18 years old, and then you start studying and you realize, oh, wait, I can't study everything happening in the whole world.
And also, you probably can't actually make a lot of change in all three of those venues.
No.
Ways of doing things. If you're going to do conflict studies and also international economics. It's a lot of competing issues, I would imagine.
Yes.
So have you developed more of an interest in health and health issues now that you work in a health agency?
Oh, absolutely. I've been there for over 6 years now. So if I had not been developing more of an interest in the field, I hope that I would have gotten out of it a while ago.
Right.
And my responsibilities have changed over the years in, you know, in my work at the office.
Can you talk a little bit more about what the Office of HIV Planning does and why it exists and what its deal is?
Sure. So it's incredibly complicated. The office sits somewhere between city government, namely the Philadelphia Department of Public Health, the federal government, and the general public, which means that naturally our work
Everybody is... loves you all the time, I'm sure.
Oh, absolutely.
You get to use those conflict skills.
I sure do. Which, understandably, people are mad for an assortment of reasons.
Yes.
And we're the messengers frequently. Mm. But being in that position puts us in a really unique spot in that we do very specific yet very broad work that comes with a lot of restrictions.
Okay.
Yeah. So now that I've given you that complete non-answer, technically our tagline is we support community planning for HIV care and prevention services in and around Philadelphia. What that actually means is there are two groups of volunteers that meet in our office. Each of them meet once a month, plus they have committees that meet once a month. One of them plans HIV prevention services for Philly, and the other one plans HIV and AIDS care services for Philadelphia and eight surrounding counties, four in New Jersey and four suburban counties in PA. Our office, as a part of that, provides all of the meeting support. So in addition to the meeting minutes and very fancy things like Cheez-Its and Snapples, we write epidemiologic profiles. We write the care and prevention plans for the city. We do a lot of community engagement, outreach, blogging, social media, and all that jazz.
And I would imagine partnering with all of the various agencies and organizations in the city that are doing HIV work.
Absolutely.
So do you do a lot of that yourself?
We all do a lot of it.
Okay.
Essentially, all of that work is done by a staff of six.
Wow.
Yes. So wow. We all do a little bit of everything, including, you know, if there's a spill in the kitchen, there's a good chance the director's helping to clean it up.
While also managing the care for HIV issues in nine counties in Pennsylvania and New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Where does your funding come from?
Our funding is 100% federal funding. Most of it comes from HRSA, which is the Health Resources and Services Administration. Mm-hmm. The rest of the funding comes from the CDC. So completely from HHS.
Okay. So, and then they're the people who I would imagine put all the restrictions on you.
That, and we also report technically to the health commissioner.
Okay.
So we have some, not all, but some city restrictions as well.
What type of restrictions are there?
What we're allowed to use funding for
is
one of them. We don't have any unrestricted funding that comes into our office.
So every dollar is already accounted for? Is that how it works?
Well, for the most part, and we're also very limited on what we can spend money on. So unlike a lot of the HIV and AIDS service organizations have at least some unrestricted grant money that comes in, we're not in that situation. So for example, not that we would use our federal funds on this anyway, but if we wanted to, we wouldn't be able to say throw a big party for all of our volunteers.
Okay.
We don't have funding for that.
Got it. And you don't have any outside donors who are willing to throw that grand party for your volunteers, or you do?
Occasionally, okay. But the position that our office has always taken is that we don't want to compete with the other organizations that provide direct services because mm-hmm. we don't provide services to clients.
Right.
We just do outreach and education type things. So occasionally the planning council will, you know, solicit donations for social events, but our office does not do that. Got we it. Allow the members to do that on their own.
That seems wise. Give people a chance to do something outside of the office. It's then you don't have to worry about getting mixed up in it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. What do those what do the educational and outreach events look like?
They're very customized based on the current needs of the community. So right now we're planning a health reform advocacy workshop on
It's September 30th when we're recording this, by the way, so we don't know what that's going to look like yet.
No, we don't. It's going to be quite an interesting several hours.
Yeah. 5.5 hours from now, healthcare.gov is going to crash. Everyone's going to sign up for health insurance at midnight.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yes.
Everyone. Everyone that knows all about it.
Yes. Who understands every bit. So you're doing some of that?
We're doing some of that. We have one of those scheduled for October 16th and another one scheduled for November 19th. So actually, they might be different depending on what happens in between.
They probably will be. It's going to be a day-by-day thing.
It sure will.
But everything is always complicated when it first starts. Nobody knows what's going to happen. And by this time next year, by this time 10 years from now, it'll be so smooth. Everyone will have health insurance. It'll be great.
And white picket fences and...
And a chicken in every pot.
Sure. So aside from that, other things we do are we educate both providers and consumers. Consumers is a term that we use for people who consume HIV and AIDS services.
I've always thought that that's a strange term to use. I interned at an agency this summer that talked about a lot about consumers, and it was very strange to me to talk about I was working with the elderly and talking about them as if they were consuming a product that they were purchasing, but really they were, it was very confusing. So it's interesting that that's in a lot of different places.
It's a really weird term. I do try not to use it when possible, but it's one of those situations that you wind up with in jargon sometimes.
Yeah.
Where you just wind up using it because it's the fastest way to communicate with the people who know what it is.
Right.
But it definitely sounds very much like they're consuming a product or, I don't know, a big gulp soda or whatever.
Exactly. It's very impersonal. Which actually, speaking of being a person, I was checking out your new blog today and your writing partner, Nicole?
Yes.
Yes. She just wrote a post about how it's most important to be a person.
She sure did.
And it was great. And your first post was great, too. So tell me about that. Also, I'm super jealous of the name. Which is
Badass Public Health.
Awesome.
Which you can view at badasspublichealth.wordpress.com.
Go there now. It's awesome.
Thank you. I'm glad you think so. Yeah, so the story behind that is Nicole and I have both felt for a long time that there are a number of things that are less than ideal about the way that public health is done.
Okay.
That no one's talking about.
Like what?
For example, people that are not acting like human beings.
Mm.
Or the way that programs and organizations tend to approach funding, like they're fighting and scrambling over it with the other organizations instead of focusing on the people they're supposed to serve.
Right.
For example.
That happens? Imagine that. You mean there's only limited amounts of money.
Shock.
To provide services to people who need them.
More and more limited over time.
Right, especially now.
Especially in about 5.5 hours.
Hopefully, by the time this is posted, there will have been no government shutdown, and this will all just be a distant memory in the past.
Sure, a girl can dream.
I hope so. So it's other than squabbling over a piece of, I imagine, like little chickens, like trying to get a worm. What are some other things that you hope to talk about? What are your hopes and dreams for the blog?
Our hopes and dreams. That's a big question.
Okay. What are you hoping to do next week with it?
Well, I am working on my next post already, which is going to be on vulnerability in the workplace.
Oh. Ooh. Like showing your own vulnerability?
Yes. And your program's vulnerability.
Oh, you mean, wow.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
It's so serious.
What does that mean, to show your program's vulnerability?
Well, because so many of us, with good reason, but because so many of us are operating from a fear-based, I might lose my money space, we have the tendency to go on the defensive and not admit the things that might be wrong or could be improved about our programs. And it's about being open to suggestions. Mm-hmm. And maybe a little criticism, and taking that in and using that to actually improve the job that you're doing.
And that's scary for a lot of reasons, because you don't want to lose your funding, you don't want to lose your job, you don't want people to think that you're not doing a good job, because what you're doing is important and makes a difference in people's health and their lives. But I would imagine that it would be terrifying to go into a board meeting and say, this was a big failure. Everything we did was just a total mess.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Well, the other thing, too, is I'm writing this post about vulnerability, which means that I have to put out the things that I'm a little freaked out by.
Like what?
Like what? See, I haven't gotten to that part of the draft post yet.
I see. So you'll have to go to badasspublichealth.wordpress.com to find out what Brianna is vulnerable about.
This sounds like a recipe for disaster.
That's really interesting, because we don't... I'm thinking about the curriculum at the school where I'm working on my MPH, and we don't talk about, or we haven't yet talked about, what to do if your program fails. We talk a lot about evaluation and making sure that you're actually achieving the goals that you set out to achieve, and to go back and make adjustments as you need to, but to actually have to say, we tried something and it was a total failure. How does somebody deal with that? What do you do after that? Do you know?
Well, personally?
Or like, just... No. Like, have you seen that happen before? Doesn't have to have happened to you.
I've seen a number of things fail miserably in my time in both my field and on this planet. Yes, I have. And it really depends on the organization and the type of leadership in the organization and what the funding stream looked like. It's... also, one of the big issues that I have with the field of public health, especially when it comes to HIV, is that there are a lot of things that are not working. And we all kind of know that they're not working.
Like what?
Like running around telling everyone to wear a condom all the time.
It's not working? People aren't doing it?
Shocking, right? Like, yes, that is great for the people who want to use condoms and who are going to use condoms, and they right. should have condoms available and all of that kind of stuff. But the condom is not enough, right?
Right.
Putting a bowl of condoms out is not going to stop the spread of HIV. There's a lot more to it than all that. And so we keep doing this thing where we're putting all of our eggs in one basket, or all of our condoms in one basket, or mm-hmm. whatever it might be. And then we're kind of acting surprised that it's not working.
Okay.
But we all know it's not working. But that's the thing that we know kind of works. So we keep doing that instead of taking chances on things that might work but might fail.
What do you have ideas of what might work but might also fail?
I'm personally, as an individual,
yes,
a huge fan of more locally grown interventions. You know, things that come out of the communities that they're supposed to serve and actually, you know, might work because the people who develop those interventions know the community and know what the challenges are there. They know what those people do on a Friday night at 11 o'clock. And that is much more effective to me than something nationwide.
Mm-hmm.
Especially something nationwide that was tested in, I'm sure, what was a very rigorous experiment 13 years ago and has been through the ringer of every kind of scientific vetting there might be.
Right, right. That actually, I know in Philly, there is an organization that I can't remember right now that does HIV testing like out on the street,
mm-hmm,
in like at night on the weekends. Is that true?
Yes.
Am I making... Okay, I'm not totally...
There are a few organizations, okay, that do that.
What,
yeah,
do you think about testing? I, in my experience, I've seen a lot of emphasis on testing and knowing your status, particularly in the city. There's all those billboards. But that's not prevention. That's just finding out if you have HIV, so that way you can start getting treated. Do you think that... What do you think about the message that's happening there?
That's an interesting question. So where that comes in as prevention is it's prevention for other people, because theoretically, once you find out your status, which this is true much of the time, but theoretically, once you get your status, or once you know what your status is, you get into care. And there's actually a lot of research that if you are on antiretroviral treatment and you get an undetectable viral load, you're significantly less likely to pass the virus on to somebody else.
Mm.
The problem that I have with that type of messaging is that it completely isolates HIV as a part of health.
Mm.
And so, for example, if you're driving around North Philly, which in Philadelphia, not all of the epidemic, but a great share of the epidemic is in North Philly and West Philly and, right, Southwest Philly. If you're driving through North Philly or West Philly and you're looking around at the neighborhoods, or if you're actually, you know, standing in them, you're just standing in them instead of driving through them. I'm usually driving through them. Other people just aren't driving through
taking
them.
Taking the subway.
Just taking the subway, or, you know, living there, for, right, example.
Yes. Lots of people live there.
Lots and lots of people live there. And there are so many competing needs. Right, when you're dealing with food instability and housing, right, issues.
And violence issues and education issues and
a million and a half that, other, yeah, things. And there's a major problem in pretty much every area that you could possibly imagine for the people who live in those neighborhoods. So if you think that if you go out after 6 p.m., there's a high probability you're going to get shot.
Mm-hmm.
Why would you care about getting an HIV test?
So now we're getting into poverty, social determinants of health, and all that great stuff.
We sure are.
Of course we are. It's a public health podcast. We've got to talk about social determinants of health. So what you're saying is that part of the issue with talking about HIV testing as something that everybody should do is that it's not a priority for everybody because everybody has different circumstances that they're dealing with?
I mean, getting an HIV test is a priority for very, very few people. It's only a priority if you feel like you are immediately at risk. Otherwise, there are a lot of other things that take higher priority.
I see. Okay. So when you say that it's isolated from health, what does that mean?
If you are in a neighborhood that has no healthcare, and you don't have health insurance, and you don't have access to any other healthy things like safe places to exercise or healthy food, then taking that one tiny little health message and trying to drop that one health message into your life is not going to make you want to be a healthy human being. It's not going to make you more able to be a healthy human being. And all it does is kind of highlight one thing that you can do, right? So you go get your HIV test, and it's either positive or negative. Most people don't know that there's free HIV care available. But there is. But most people don't know that. And if you don't know that that's available, or even if you do know that that's available, let's say you go get the HIV test. Great. They tell you that you have HIV. Well, now how are you going to get to the doctor? It's one more thing that you have to worry about. And if they don't tell you you have HIV, it's like, great. Well, that checks off one of 9,000 other things that could be wrong with me. I also have a weird looking mole and like my stomach hurts.
So what do you think would be a better way to do that kind of, like, to encourage people to get HIV tests? Do you think that that's even something we should be encouraging outside of a regular annual physical, or should it be something that's separate and something that has to be pushed as an individual, speaking as an individual?
Of course.
Yes.
As an individual who has no affiliations of any kind, aside from to public or badass public health, aside from that, my personal opinion is that you have people who don't even have access to annual physicals, right? And we still don't know what our governor is doing with Medicaid expansion,
right,
and all that. But if we could focus more on general wellness messaging, and particularly sexual wellness messaging, then I think we would do a lot better in terms of getting people to care and be interested that there are things available for them to access.
So even if it doesn't seem like living a healthy lifestyle would be easy in your environment, maybe making it feel like it's a little bit more, it's an actual reachable goal.
Not Is even that, a whole no? healthy lifestyle, just little things that you can do that make things better. The problem with, well, one of the problems with the sole HIV test message is that it's, first of all, too narrow in focus. And second of all, it has that air of, you've probably done something wrong.
Yeah.
So you should go get an HIV test. And for me, my assumption is, if I'm looking at that billboard, is great. So I can go to a doctor or a mobile testing van,
right,
and get an HIV test. And then somebody will tell me that I need to stop doing the things that I'm doing, and it'll be awkward.
And it's all my fault.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. That's, yeah. Well, I am struck. I'm trying to remember what the billboards look like. And all I can remember are images of men.
Mm-hmm.
Is it targeted? Do you know if it's targeted towards men? Is that the constituency that they're going for? Because women also get HIV. Women also have to get HIV tested.
Interesting you should mention that.
Mm.
So one of the biggest growing demographics we have in our city is young MSM, which is men who have sex with men, which includes gay, bi, or any other men who have sex with men, even if they're not gay or bi identified.
Right.
So like men on the down low,
mm-hmm,
for example. And that is a huge, scary, like incredibly scary demographic. I remember getting a presentation from the city epidemiologist a couple years ago at work, where she told us that 25% of new cases were among 13 to 24-year-olds in Philadelphia, which is horrifying. And many of those cases were among MSM. But at the same time, you do have all of these women who are completely at risk. And it's not the biggest demographic, but it is a big one. And we are missing out on them a lot.
Do you know what the rate of new HIV infections in Philadelphia for women is?
I don't offhand.
Okay.
I know where you can find that.
Where can you find it?
You can find that on my office's website.
Ooh.
www.hivphilly.org/documents.html.
Wow. Yeah. That's your website coordinator for you right there. Because I often wonder about that. And I mean, MSM, men who have sex with men, are definitely one of the, I mean, they are the major group that HIV prevention efforts are targeted towards, but there are lots of other people who are getting HIV. And I often wonder if we're messaging towards these men and really leaving other people behind. Particularly, I'm thinking about like teenagers, who I know that in Philadelphia, at least, condom use is down. And that's not going to bode very well for the city if we don't figure that out. I mean, going back to the bowl full of condoms issue, but you know, there are increasing rates of chlamydia and gonorrhea in the city among teens, and if we're not talking to them about HIV specifically, and we're not being sure that they know that they that there are behaviors that they may or may not be participating in that can cause them to become infected with HIV, we're going to have a way bigger problem on our hands.
Yes, especially because we have a tendency to focus on things that have symptoms or even instances that have symptoms. So there are tons of people that have STDs and don't know they have STDs, which are actually affecting their bodies in different ways, but not in particularly gross ones that they've noticed.
Right.
And our sex ed so largely focuses on if you have unprotected sex, you will get this weird oozy thing, right? And that's it.
And a baby and you'll die.
And yes, possibly all at the same time. And when you do that, it actually worsens the problem because now you have all these people who are wandering, people, kids, teenagers, whatever, that are wandering around thinking that they are fine because they don't have any symptoms.
And, interesting.
And if they think they're fine, they're not going to change their behavior. And if they don't change their behavior, then somebody else is going to catch one of these things.
Right.
And may or may not know it. And then you get in a whole social networking problem.
Right. Right. And that, I mean, that's the part about HIV and, these pockets of teens in the city is that right now there's not any HIV really in those groups, but it's just going to take one person. And then, it, you know, and so I guess my question is, what can we do about those teenagers? I mean, we're not going to stop them from having sex. We know that.
No, so no, we're not.
Is there any, like, what do you think would be something we could do about that to help that situation not devolve into horribleness?
Well, one thing that we've talked about with several younger people that come to meetings at my office is we've had a ton of conversations about how we talk about why you should use a condom.
Mm-hmm.
And how to use a condom.
Very important.
Yes. Hugely important and something that most people are awful at, shockingly enough. Because it seems like it might be straightforward, but that's what condom demonstrations are for. Anyway.
The banana.
The banana. Yes. Or if you're especially lucky, the dildo.
Ooh.
Yeah.
That would be, that would never have flown in my sex ed as a kid.
Oh, no, this is usually, like, community-based organization outreach kind of stuff.
Okay. Okay, good. I don't even think we got the banana in my high school.
I'm pretty sure we didn't either. I don't ever remember seeing a condom when I was in high school. I mean, at the school.
In class.
In class.
Right. We had this horrible slideshow of, I refer to it now as STDs gone wrong. And it was like, they found people with, like, the worst syphilis you've ever seen. And just showed us these slideshows of, like, untreated gonorrhea, what you look like when you don't. And it was definitely one of those scare you straight kind of things.
See, and that's not fair either, because then those poor kids get gonorrhea or chlamydia, and then they think they don't have it, and it must be some minor little thing because it doesn't look like the slides.
It was terrifying. It was so, it freaked me out so much. It was very upsetting. I can close my eyes now and still remember what one of those slides looks like.
Like, I'm kind of freaked out about it, and I haven't even seen them.
Yeah, just think, it's like the worst thing you can imagine.
The worst parts of Google Images.
Duh, yes. Have you seen those pictures of the crocodile?
No.
Oh, God. Don't search for that. It's this new. It's a drug that's super popular in Russia.
Oh, that. I saw some of those pictures while ago.
It's used as like a heroin substitute, and it's injected, and then the life expectancy for somebody who uses crocodile is like 2 years, and it just rots your flesh off. And it's the worst thing I've ever seen, and I'm mad at myself for looking at it. But let's talk about HIV.
That's fun.
Let's go back to HIV.
Something that seems nice in comparison.
I guess. So the kids come to the office. They've talked about how they should talk more about using condoms.
Well, so right. Everyone knows that you're supposed to use a condom, right? Just like you're supposed to eat salad and not smoke and go to the gym 3 to 4 times a week and whatever. Right. All of the things that we know we're supposed to do. But the part of the problem is we don't teach any kind of condom negotiation skills.
Mm.
And also what context to have those conversations in. At what point do you bring up the condom thing? I mean, so much of our human interaction is based on this fear of being rejected by somebody else. And if you are out with somebody that you think is really awesome and you want them to like you, and you're afraid that they won't like you if you bring up the condom thing, or even if they might see that you have a human fault, the human fault being that, I don't know, you care about your own health.
You don't trust them.
Right. It's so often a trust thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're supposed to know, whatever. That's a whole nother thing. But we don't give people those skills. We don't teach them how to have those conversations. We don't teach communication on any level when it comes to relationships or, like, let alone the sex part.
Right.
To kids. And it's so awkward at that age. Always. It's always awkward and weird.
And you barely even want to admit that you like this person, let alone that you don't know if they have any diseases that you don't want to get.
Exactly. And then you have this thing going on. It's like, oh, you want to have sex with me? That's cool, I guess. And then on the inside, you're all super excited about it, but you don't know what you're doing. And
I mean, and part of me wants to say, you know, they're kids. They're kids. I mean, they're teenagers. The only way they're ever going to learn is by making mistakes. But when you're talking about the mistake being getting HIV, that's a hell of a mistake to make. Like, that's not, it can't be that, you know, because in some ways, like, you have to get your heart broken the first time, so that way the next time you know what's at stake.
Oh, it's so romantic. In a very emo kind of way.
I am super emo. but you know, that's part of the process of growing up, is like really liking somebody and they don't like you back, or really thinking that this is the person that you're going to be with forever, and then it all crumbles because you're 18 years old, and now I'm speaking from experience, and you have no idea who you are as a person yet. But this is a totally different situation. We can't let, this is not trial and error. This is not grow up and you'll figure it out eventually. This is actual real life and death kinds of situations. You're talking about getting a disease that's going to stay with you forever and has the potential to kill you. So I don't know, teens, HIV, we're not going to solve it right now.
Well, you know how we fix that.
How?
Sex positive sex ed.
Oh, really? And what does that look like?
Well, it starts out with the premise that sex can be fun,
right?
Imagine that.
Mm.
Instead of the scary thing that gives you syphilis.
Oh, God, yeah.
Sorry, I didn't mean to bring that up for you again.
It's back in my head.
But if we are able to talk with people about sex, and we can't even do this with adults right now, so I don't know how to make this happen, but if we can talk to people about sex as though it's a fun thing that is to be enjoyed, and there's also a couple of other things that in order to have sex, like, you need to take care of yourself.
Right.
And, you know, have open and honest communication with your partner if that is an option for you.
Right.
And when I say an option for you, I mean, like, you're not in physical danger for communicating with your partner. Not like, well, he might not like me and I feel a little weird about it.
Right. I'm embarrassed, so I don't want to do it.
Right.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that should be, that'll solve all the problems.
It sure will.
Well, it'll certainly make things better. If we can talk about sex like it's part of the human experience, because it is. It's just like everything else that you do as a human. You know, like you're not ever, not talking about it doesn't make it go away.
Right.
So if we need people to grow up and be healthy people, we need to teach them from an early age how to talk about sex and how to, like you were saying, like the condom negotiation skills. That's important stuff.
Mm-hmm.
For sure. So let's switch gears a little bit. I want to talk about Code for America. Tell me about this, you little nerd.
I am a huge nerd. I am one of the nerdiest of the nerds. What are you going to do? So Code for America is a national, like, civic hacking thing. And civic hacking, I will try to explain. I will probably do it very poorly. I also just tried to explain what this civic hacking thing is to my mother on the phone the other day, and yeah, it didn't go so well. She was like, so you're stopping hackers for the CDC? And I was like, no. No, not quite. So civic hacking is just doing coding and programming and web design and stuff for civic good.
Right? Okay.
And Code for America is a national thing, and it's Code for Philly locally, and they meet up every Tuesday night to develop apps and other nice things that are for the social good.
Mm.
So, for example, one of the other types of projects is last weekend, I guess September 20th, whatever weekend that was.
2 weeks.
Yeah, if that's a weekend at all. Whenever you're listening to this, sometime in September, there was a transit apps hackathon that was put on by Code for Philly, along with SEPTA and some other partners, where they worked on different projects that would improve the transit experience.
Like what?
So I wasn't there for the whole thing. I was there for the opening reception where they talked about the ideas, but some of the most popular ideas were one app that would do a cost-benefit analysis based on your starting point and your ending point and your mode of transportation.
Oh, so if it's cheaper to walk or take the bus?
Yes.
Oh, that would be great.
Right?
That would be awesome.
People were very excited about it.
I would love that.
And there was another one, this was super cool, about for recently released prisoners that would plot organizations that have resources for people that are recently released against modes of transit for those individual people.
Oh, wow. That's also super cool.
Yeah.
Because if you can get there by bus or subway, you're a lot more likely to get there.
Exactly.
Than if it's in one of those awful parts of Philadelphia where you can't get there.
Or if it's... Right. Or if it's one of those places that's like halfway across or not even that far away, but there's just no way to get there.
Yeah.
From where you are. Like you might be able to get there from Center City, but not, you know, yeah. Olney.
Yeah, exactly. That's really interesting. So are you working on any projects in particular?
Yes, I am working on a project that takes our office's epidemiologic profile, which is a massive, roughly 400-page PDF with 219 tables in it.
I've read a substantial portion of it. Not for fun. For school and for work. But it's great. It has so much information in it.
Thank you.
Did you write it?
Not personally. Oh. Not this time.
Next time.
A little bit. Not too much, though. Just it's a little long. Bit around the edges. But it does happen in our office with our giant staff of six.
Wow.
And
219 tables?
Yeah.
Wow.
So, and I've been taking those 219 tables and converting them to Google Fusion tables so that we can basically take that data out of a ridiculously unwieldy PDF
mm-hmm.
and put it into a web app that people can search through and manipulate the data and, you know, make shiny looking tables and graphs and charts and things.
So when I used the report for a paper that I had to write in my first quarter getting my MPH, If this web app existed, my life would have been like 10,000 times easier.
Probably.
Well, get working on it.
Well, now that I know the paper's done, I guess I can take my time.
Oh, more people will need it. Don't worry. That's really cool. And so what is the intended audience for that? Who's going to use that?
Well, right now we have a very limited audience, which primarily includes people who would just so happen to know to navigate to our office's HIV website and open up a 400-page PDF in the hopes that it might have the information that they're looking for.
Right.
There's not too much in the way of HIV and AIDS data for Philadelphia that's optimized for the web. Pretty much everything is done in this big old paper-based format because the reason it exists is so we can ship it off to the federal government or the state government or whoever it might be. And so the intention is to take that data and make it more accessible for an average end user. Maybe somebody that's writing a paper for high school on HIV in Philadelphia.
Mm.
Or all diseases in Philadelphia. Our epidemiologic profile contains a wide variety of information on different diseases and STDs well beyond HIV and AIDS.
Right. And it's going to be a web app?
Yes.
And what does that mean?
It means that it's going to be basically a website that you can go to and really manipulate the data and play around with it and make it do things. As opposed to a static website where you just go to the website and you click on it and it brings up one table and you're like, oh, okay, there's a table.
Right. But this could be, I want to see HIV incidence rates in counties 19147 and 19136 only. And then you could see all of that?
Yes.
Okay.
So you can play with it more.
Ah, that's very cool. So you can make all kinds of comparisons and you could pull out some information and leave other information out. And
that's the idea.
That's super cool. And you're making that.
Well, with a team of other people. It's not just me.
You are making that with a team. That's awesome. Do you know how? Did you know how to code before this?
You're making it sound like I know how to code now.
You're coding for Philly, so.
I am coding for Philly. There are a lot more people who are much more adept at the coding bit than I am. I'm learning as I go, and that's a large part of the reason why I'm depending so heavily on other people to help me do it. I mean, when I started working at my job about 9,000 years ago, I didn't know how to do any kind of coding of any kind.
Mm-hmm.
And so almost everything that I've learned has been on a, oh, this thing looks cool and my interests exceed my abilities. Let me see if I can learn how to do that.
That's the best way to learn, though. It's better to learn about things that you're interested in than things that you're not interested in that you have to.
Problem is I am interested in entirely too many things.
One step at a time. That's all you gotta do. So if somebody wanted to find you and talk to you personally, how would they get in touch with you?
If somebody wanted to find me.
Like if somebody thought that you were super charming and they want to talk to you about HIV stuff, where could they find you?
Well, I am on Twitter.
Yes.
You can find me on Twitter at Babe from Toyland.
One of my favorite Twitter handles ever.
I'm glad you like it.
I do.
I'm not going to spell it for you. It's just Babe from Toyland. And if you can't figure out how to spell that, then you don't need to be following me on Twitter.
That's true. Sound it out. You'll get it.
Exactly.
Phonics.
It's definitely some 18 plus target audience stuff. So if you can't spell it that level, like.
And then your blog is?
My blog is badasspublichealth.wordpress.com, where I blog with Nicole Johns as well.
And then if anybody needs any information about HIV in Philadelphia, they can go to the website that you're in charge of.
Yes, www.hivphilly.org.
That's awesome. Well, thanks so much for talking with me.
Well, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. So that was Brianna Morgan. Wasn't she delightful? She is just lovely. So Action Phase is all about public health action, actually doing public health. So I'm going to give you at the end of each episode a couple action items, things that you can do that can allow you to engage either with your community or with somebody or something that you haven't really thought a lot about. So, number one, I want you to look around the city that you live in, town, whatever, and I want you to see if there are any HIV testing messages out and about. So in Philadelphia, we have lots of billboards that encourage people getting tested. Take a look at what they're saying, how they're saying it, and who they're saying it to, and really think about if that makes sense to you. If it doesn't, get in touch with the people who are making those messages and tell them what you don't like about it. You know, we want to make sure that health messaging is inclusive and, you know, is appropriate for the people who are hearing it. So, you know, take it upon yourself to get involved with that. The other thing that I want you to take a look at is Code for America. Brianna mentioned that she is working on a web app, and I want you to take a look at Code for America and see what they are doing in your area. See if there's anything that you want to get involved in, because maybe there's, you know, some project that's totally perfect for you and you want to do it. And then sign up and do it and get out there and meet some new people and learn some new skills. It'll be great. So thank you so much for listening. If you want to get in touch with me, you can get me on Twitter at Tegan Keating, TEAGANKEATING. You can also get me on my site, TeganK.com, TEAGAN, the letter K, .com. Action Phase, the podcast, also has a website, actionphasepodcast.com, and a Twitter that's not quite up and running yet, and that's Action Phase Podcast. So, thanks so much, and I'll see you next week.